Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I don't love you anymore. It's just a simple.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a lot going on when it comes to our health, and I'm going to be sharing the latest on how to live a longer and healthier life. Then we're going to take a look at the new left, the new liberal, the new Democrat. Kind of reminds me of when Clinton and Gore became the new Democrat Party. What happened? What went wrong? Why have we not been paying attention to the details? Well, because most people have a life to live, and they assume that the people they elect for office will be looking after the best interest. Boy, that's a big error in judgment. So we're going to revisit some of the things going on currently and why we should all be concerned, what we can do about it. What are the solutions? Also, we'll hear from Chris Hedges today in an interview with Robert Scheer. Now, Robert is the publisher of Truthdig, one of the most respectable and responsible online information and news sources there is. Chris Hedges is the editor-in-chief, and they make some very important points, points that should have been self-evident to anyone who was paying attention. Obviously was not. So we're going to explore that today. Now, I'm on a telephone today, so I apologize. Hopefully tomorrow I'll be back on my microphone, and everything will be sound a little better. And also I won't be interrupted by calls coming in. I have no control of that. So we're going to have some good insights. Also, tomorrow we're going to take an honest look at NPR. Now, they have some good programs, and they do some good reporting, but who's behind the scenes controlling so much of their programs, so much you see, not only on NPR, but what you hear on NPR, but what you see on PBS? Because I've had 37 different original specials on PBS and have had a very strong friendship with one of, if not the most successful producer in PBS history, I have some unique insights I'll be able to share to at least keep it in perspective as to why you will hear things going on unchallenged. And they should be challenged. You know, when you have doctors coming on saying that certain things don't work and don't try it, and if you're not getting a vaccine, that's irresponsible. With all the resource money they have, surely they could do some of their own independent research and find the truth, and then say to these people coming on, by the way, we're going to have Dr. Suzanne Humphreys or Dr. Gary Null or some of the others who spent 15,000 hours, who've written multiple scholarly articles on vaccine to debate you. Then let's see if you hear those same people on Alone, in effect, just offering completely fraudulent propaganda. So the truth behind NPR tomorrow. Also, I have a clip on what's happening today from Lee Camp with the fires in California. This is the untold story of the fires in California. We're aware of what's been at least provided in the news or over the Internet about, I think it's close to 9,000 buildings and homes destroyed. I'm not sure. I don't have the latest figures on death toll. But it's the worst fire in California history. That becomes the new normal. But now there's a story behind that story. You'll hear that today. And the latest on the environmental issues around the world. That also today. So you see, we have a packed show. Let's begin. First up, group exercise improves the quality of life and reduces stress far more than individual workouts. This is in the University of New England College of Medicine. It says, and this is published in the Journal of the American Osteopathic Association, says, researchers found working out in a group lowers stress by 26% and significantly improves quality of life, while those who exercise individually but in more effort, put in more effort, but experience no significant changes in their stress level. I would agree, and I would disagree with that. I think there's something to be learned from this. I cannot give you the total numbers, but at least we start with the Natural Living Running and Walking Club, which is one of the oldest running and walking clubs in New York City. I founded it back in 1976, and so it's been around a while. And we've trained about 30,000 people to do the New York City Marathon, but we've trained a lot more than that who didn't want to do the marathon, just get into shape. when you speak with many of the athletes coming or non-athletes who want to be athletic, the reason they come is because they feel comfortable in a social environment. They're able to meet other athletes and people who share similar concerns, like a lot of people are overweight. They don't want to be in that environment where they feel shame. Some have told me this. When they go into a gym and they see all these really trim, fit people, and they feel embarrassed, so they stop going. That's unfortunate. But when you're in a group of people where a lot of them are starting out of shape and overweight, then they have a motivation. They want to be with a group, and that's fine. Because in time, they're not going to be that overweight. They're going to lose that weight. So on that level, I absolutely agree with them. I've seen it. I've also seen the opposite, meaning individuals working out alone, especially those who tend to be long-distance training. They more often than not tend to be in their own meditative state. They appreciate silence. They're not there to socialize or emotionalize. They're there to train. Those people tend to do very well. Now, having done both, it's always fun to go out and work out with someone, especially if they're at your pace or you're at their pace. And I remember once there were a group of us running around Center Park, and these were the fastest people in our group, and there were about 30 that could all run pretty much the same pace. And we're doing a comfortable 502 mile, 458 to 502, and that's moving. Because remember, we're not just doing 1 mile. And we're talking, having fun, and two guys ran by us talking, and they were so relaxed. But we're estimating they were at a low 4 minute mile because they were really pumping. So one of the guys decided, let's try to see if we can catch up with them. They were called the Rabbits, and anytime you want to really train yourself, you get someone who's faster than you, let them go out, you try to catch them. Well, we couldn't catch them, and they never stopped. Just kind of, they just seemed to be so relaxed and smooth, and it shows you, you know, you train with people that are challenging you, and you always get a little better that way. Otherwise, you can end up what we call a junk exercise, and I've seen so many people indulge in this. They go out and they stay at the level where they're comfortable. They never go faster or slower. But you have to push yourself. You have to do some interval training. If you're going to go for a 6 mile run, then maybe do 2 miles that fast, but you can do it in half mile increments. That challenging yourself or becoming more intense in your exercise in the gym or on a track or on a bike, that really helps you. And it's sending messages to your muscles to remember that you can go faster, you can be stronger, you can put in more intensity in the exercise. So I think both are true. But for the average person, absolutely, having a workout companion makes a difference. And by the way, I once did up in Connecticut, I think it was Stanford, there was a East Coast Championship, and it was race walking. And Marianne Trellis, one of America's greatest Hall of Famer race walkers, was in it, and she was coordinating it and organized it. Now, I had never been in a mall early in the morning, and the place was packed with older adults. And so I was curious. So before the race started, I asked, you know, what are you doing this for? Oh, because it's good all year round. It's air conditioned in the summer. It's warm in the winter. You're not going to be hurt and no one know it. You're with people, all ages, mainly older people, and it's a safe environment. So I really encourage people to do power walking wherever possible, not race walking, power walking, but keep it vigorous. Alpha-lipoic acid, a nutrient you don't hear a lot about, lipoic, L-I-P-O-I-C, very beneficial. I was reading an article by Dr. Burton Berskin, MD, PhD, and he is very much up on this, so I decided to see what the latest research was, and indeed, he is correct, especially when it comes to liver. Now, in the United States now, and I've spoken about this on many occasions, we have what is called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. why non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? Because you almost always see people been drinkers, even moderate drinkers, with excess fat in the liver, which is really bad for your liver. Cirrhosis of the liver, which is scarring of the tissue, also bad. And various forms of hepatitis, also bad for the liver. Well, currently, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is the number one liver ailment in the United States. How many people? 100 million. That's nearly 28% of the entire American population. Well, if you take out babies and children, you're looking at one-third of the American population suffer from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And in fact, it constitutes 75% of all chronic liver disease. Why? Well, if you're diabetic or you're overweight, you're more likely to have it. But then in can come alpha-lipoic acid and help you. There are new studies showing that liver protection can come from taking alpha-lipoic acid each day. And I think that's extremely important. In fact, you can actually help reverse that, especially if you've been taking some of the toxic medications that people generally take for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is very much in alignment with metabolic syndrome. Now, you've heard me mention that's a cluster of harmful conditions: high blood pressure, high blood sugar, abdominal fat, and different types of triglyceride levels. And generally, it can hit anyone from your 30s to your 70s. Now, there's two forms of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. In steatosis, the milder and reversible form, the deposits of fat haven't yet caused inflammation or tissue damage. And the more serious form, which is a non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, you have very severe scarring in the liver, and it generally isn't reversible. But alpha-lipoic acid, which, by the way, is an organosulfur compound, the body does produce it, but it's best to take extra. It protects your fragile mitochondria, where your energy is created. It promotes efficient metabolism, which helps women in particular who may have underactive thyroid, especially postmenopause. It's a great antioxidant. It destroys a lot of free radicals. And it's both water-soluble and fat-soluble. That means it literally is able to be used inside and penetrate the cells and outside the cells. In fact, alpha-lipoic acid recharges and regenerates other liver protective antioxidants, including vitamin C and glutathione, your most important nutrient for your liver, and coenzyme Q10. It also helps detoxify the body of heavy metals like mercury and lead. So that's what's important. So make sure you're getting your, I would say, on the low end, 150, on the high end, 600 milligrams a day. And that's important. Now, from the University of Melbourne, there's a study talking about, well, gluten-free diets. Okay. Today, you really don't have a problem. Most restaurants will offer you some gluten-free breads. Health food stores are loaded with different varieties of gluten-free products. But if you're the average person and you shouldn't have gluten and you do, is there anything you can do to help yourself? Well, if you've got celiac disease, you eat gluten, you've got some real serious abnormal immune reactions, inflammation, damage to the small bowel lining. But the trouble doesn't always go away for those celiac sufferers who stay away from gluten. Studies have shown that even after years on a gluten-free diet, you can still end up having problems with your bowel and suffer the symptoms. Now, some people simply have a hard time adhering to a diet. Also, many of the people we love, our friends and our family members, they simply don't care. You have no idea. I wished you would have grown up in my household, and you'd have seen that I think they went out of their way every day just to play a joke on me by doing everything they could to harm themselves and then smiling like, it doesn't matter. It does. And then you got the people who are indifferent. Well, prove to me that, you know, if cola was bad, they wouldn't advertise it all over the world. Hmm? Well, smoking was bad. They advertised it everywhere, still do. And they just don't have doctors, 46,000 doctors smoking Chesterfields, or Camel's the preferred soothing of the lungs for women. They can't do that today, thank goodness. But it doesn't mean people are going to stop a bad habit. So what do we do? One of the things we can do, by the way, gluten is also a creator of anxiety. And even minimal exposure, it can adversely affect the brain as well. So we can do something simple, easy. Simply have some enzyme tablets, or better still, the whole fruit, the papaya. Because there's a lack of an enzyme known as endopeptidase, which digests what is called gliadin into harmless fragments. Without the enzyme, the immune response kicks in and results in gut inflammation. And that's where you can get your digestive enzymes if you have any form of gluten intolerance, or to have yourself papaya, which is good, it has it. And they've actually done double-blind placebo-controlled studies, and it makes a big difference. So papaya, after a meal, not a lot, maybe a cup, can make a big difference in helping you. Or simply get the enzyme in their natural enzymes you can get. And also another thing papaya does is the papaya leaf. The papaya leaf juice successfully used for anemia and viral infections and overall good health. We were getting at the Tri-State Healing Center years ago in the 1990s and 80s, everyone who had AIDS, and there were 1,200 people that I was working with, the medical staff was treating for full-blown AIDS, not just HIV infection, but otherwise asymptomatic. I'm talking about people with ARC and Kaposi's sarcoma, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. These were really sick people. And what was important was that they wanted to be there as a group, so they would ask, could they come in and all be together? I said, sure. So in the evenings, generally from 6 till midnight, 6 hours, you would have about 3 different groups of people in there every night, 7 nights a week. And some were on an intensive protocol. Others were not. But even those that were not on an intensive protocol were still getting 100,000 milligrams of vitamin C about 3 days a week. But it was the juices, bitter melon juice, 3 times a day, fresh made. And it's inexpensive, by the way. It's so bitter, people don't eat it. But it comes from the Caribbean. It's common there, and it's been used in folk medicine for a long time, where there's good science on bitter melon. But so, too, is soursop, and so, too, is papaya leaf. And we had a medical kitchen where all people did all day long was make fresh organic juices and give them to the people as they were sitting there getting their drips, whatever therapy they were getting. And we saw remarkable results. Just as an aside, in the we had one groom, and this was nothing, you know, one room, there were 2 drip rooms, and one room would have people with AIDS because they wanted to be with themselves. We said, fine. And they were sharing stories. Oh, I came from Los Angeles. I came from San Francisco. You know, there were 200 people in my AIDS support group. They're all dead. There were 2,000 in one guy's health support groups over years. They all died. And yet they didn't want to hear. The heads of the groups did not want people to know about natural, non-toxic therapies. And it was like this big secret within the AIDS community. Drugs, yes. AZT, the more the better. Protease inhibitors, DDI, DDC, and all the other variations, yes. Juicing, vitamin drips, no. And yet they had people dying by the hundreds of thousands using AZT, and we didn't have anyone die. Everybody was getting healthier. Takes time, but that's a fact. Now, here's the irony. And you talk about racism in America, and you talk about self-censoring in the news, and you talk about corporate sponsorship of gay and AIDS organizations, and you talk about how you can control a large group with a small number, 1% can control 99% if you have access to the media and the legislation. You become the policymaker and opinion leader, and that's what happened. But not when it came to the black community. Bill Tatum, Stokely Hart, Stokely Carmichael, dozens of very famous African Americans came, interviewed the people. Some came night after night after night, asked to look at the medical records with the patient's permission, and saw these were not placebo effects. These were real. Blood chemistry is done on a regular basis, viral loads coming down, immune system percolating up, and they wrote about it in the AmSAM News. And it was because of Doug Henderson, a black attorney, who was also a journalist and wrote for many different black publications, including AmSAM News, who got the Walter Reed Theater to premiere the first documentary I did on AIDS down at Lincoln Center, packed, mobbed. And who was there? The African-American community. Who was not there? The Caucasian community. Who was not there? The media. Who was not there? We did a press conference at the same time, and we had at least 200 people in that audience were people who had been successfully treated for AIDS, and there was a news blackout, total news blackout. What was interesting is that the liberal community, the liberal media, hostile, and not only just saying, we're not going to come, we don't believe it, but actually attacking the people at AIDS, attacking the doctors, attacking nurses, attacking me. And you think, why? If you're a real journalist, come and do your homework. Tony Brown at Tony Brown's Journal on PBS did. He had eight of these people on his show over a two-year period. It's a matter of history. You'd never know it. You'd never know it was a press conference. You'd never know it. All the things that were done, you'd never know. But that is racism 101, and shame on those people, because my memory is very long. I don't forget who had the truth, could have found it and published it and didn't, but they were so willing to promote new drugs. Are they going to be held morally liable for promoting drugs that were later found out that they, at the time they could have found out, were dangerous? No. No one's ever held responsible for any of this in the media, and that's unfortunate. But anyhow, we were doing the right thing. We were making the juices. Now, here's the latest on papaya. And this is from Natural Health. It's the latest update. First of all, it's been used in Ayurvedic medicine, in Chinese medicine, in Native American, in the Americas medicines, not to mention in many traditional medical systems. And that's herbal medicine. And plants, like papaya, have been a key to Ayurvedic medicine. Well, one plant that has served as a popular source of herbal medicine for centuries is what is called the Kariska papaya. And different parts of the papaya plant have long been used as ingredients in folk medicine, including the fruit itself. As I just mentioned before, it's great for digestion. And the dried version of it, seeds, leaves, dried leaves, as well as the papaya, are all a part of that. And researchers at the Asian Institute of Science and Technology first established a papaya leaf juice for low platelet count works effectively for patients suffering from dengue fever. And dengue fever is a mild disease transmitted by mosquitoes and affects millions globally. And people have died from it, of course, and it's a major symptom is a thrombocytopenia, a medical term for low platelet count. And so it helped substantially. Just wanted to share something that generally people don't know. Just one more way to help your blood and your blood platelets. And finally, lifestyle changes end up with a healthier population. This University of Basque in Spain. And by the way, I'm one of those people who believe that the Basque community should be able to have a referendum on having total independence. I believe that what Spain is doing right now is setting the stage for a potential catastrophic outcome. If you have 500,000 more or less individuals within one area of Spain that want their independence in the Catalonian, and you say no, and you have a giant march in the middle of, I think it's Madrid, saying you stay a part of greater Spain, then that just keeps conflict going up until there's going to be serious problems, possibly even as bad as a civil war. This is where the world community is staying silent or unaware this is happening. And you should have an international symposium of scholars and people who are not from Spain, not affiliated, but who share some insights to try to mediate this before it gets out of hand, which right now it's about to get out of hand because they've already told the leader of their community to step down, and that isn't going to go well. In any case, the obesity and high blood pressure frequently go hand in hand. They coexist in the same individual. And these are your main cardiovascular risk factors. And the prevalence of hypertension, and that's defined as systolic arterial pressure of 140 mmHg and or diastolic arterial pressure at 90 mmHg, and then almost always you prescribe antihypertensive pharmaceutical therapy. About 40% of the entire population, adult population, are taking these. And that's terrible. And what's more, it's estimated right now that 69% of the population are overweight and obese, and 35% are seriously, morbidly obese. And that's why when controlling and preventing hypertension as well as cardiovascular disease, it's necessary to quantify cardiovascular risks, since even though a very small fraction of the hypertensive population has only high blood pressure, the vast majority of people display additional risk factors like obesity, diabetes, and physical inactivity. So here's what it comes down to. The general difference is known to exert a different effect on the development of hypertension and cardiovascular risk. So if you were to eat a plant-based diet, that reduces the risk. If you're to exercise 6 days a week for 45 minutes, that reduces the risk. If you're keeping your body trim, and ideally, in my opinion, men 12%, women no more than 16%, up to 16% body mass index or fat, and really get the fat on the belly down and out, because that's the biggest risk. And then make sure that you're getting yourself on some juices, then your chances of having a high blood pressure to begin with are remote. You're a tiny little thing. And also, when you're eating a healthy diet, you are having a healthier digestive system. So go on caloric restrictions 1 day a week, modified fasting. That promotes longevity through health of the mitochondrial network. And by the way, that's from Harvard School of Public Health, published in Cell Metabolism. So when you restrict calories, but a pizza isn't a restriction, a donut's not a bagel's not a restriction, ice cream's not a restriction, that big steak is not a restriction, fried food's not a restriction, the colas are not a restriction. That's just the opposite. It's excess calorie intake. And then comes the activation of the AMP protein kinase, and AMP kinase is an energy-sensing protein on longevity, and Harvard researchers have determined that the AMPK and calorie restriction promote homeostasis and the pliability of the networks formed by the cell's power plants, the mitochondria. And mitochondria networks change shape according to energy demand. So if you're not exercising, you'll have one change. If you are exercising, you'll have a different change. So you want to live longer? Restrict calories to what your body requires. And if you want to live shorter, well, just keep doing more of the same, and that'll happen. So that's the latest on health and healing. We're halfway through our program. I'm Gary Nall on location. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Baby, baby, it looks like it's gonna hail. Baby, baby, it looks like it's gonna hail. You better come inside, let me teach you how to jive and wheel. Oh, you gotta jump and jive and bend your wheel. You gotta jump and jive and bend your wheel. You gotta jump and jive and
Then you really gotta jump jiving. Then you really gotta jump.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. And by the way, please write down this number because Monday to Friday, noon to 1, you can tune in and listen live over any listening device, cell phone and landline phone. And that number is 424-203-8046. This is Listen Live over telephone if you're not at home, if you're traveling. In fact, right now there are people in their taxi cabs. I know a lot of taxi cab drivers listen to this show. And a lot of people from Haiti who drive cabs listen to the show or have car services. So they're listening by putting it on, dialing 424-203-8046. But if you can't, you got to listen at night, which most people do. Simple. Call the archive number and download a show, up to 5 shows. This is also good for Canadians. The number is 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. I'm going to play you now Lee Camp on what we weren't told about the fires in Canada and why this is important that we know this. I know that the people in this audience are very concerned about the exploitation of labor. This is severe exploitation of labor. Let's listen now to the California fires, the untold story. It's a short piece.
So as you might have heard, California is on fire.
California's fire season has been particularly fierce this year, with fires consuming nearly 800,000 acres. Fire seasons are growing more intense, extending longer into fall, and demanding more resources.
In fact, these are the deadliest fires ever recorded in California's history. And you will hear reports on the forest fires, but what you won't hear is even more interesting.
One solution is to use inmates to fight fires.
Camp 13 is a inmate firefighter camp where we are on call up to 7 days a week. We can be called out at any time, day or night.
We basically fight fires.
Yay, women! Women inmates fighting fires makes them feel good, awesome. All right, job is done, let's go home. And what's a sandwich? Here are just a few words not included in NBC's video on the inmates fighting these fires. Capitalism, slave labor, forced labor, prison industrial complex, police state, profit, climate change? How about climate change? Don't want to factor that in there somewhere? Anyway, we'll get to climate change in a minute. But first, let's talk about these inmates. As the New York Times claims in their article about it, by choice, for less than $2 an hour, the female inmate firefighters of California worked their bodies to the breaking point. The New York Times reporter said, "I could see why inmates would accept the risks. Compared with life among the general prison population, the conservation camps are bastions of civility. They are less violent and offer more space. They smell of eucalyptus, the ocean, fresh blooms." Ah, fresh blooms as you fight fires as a slave laborer. Keep in mind, per capita, we are the number one prison nation on this planet. So when you're stuck in prison and you're given a choice of, well, you can go out onto the roads and fight fires and, you know, be out in the sun all day, or you can stay here in a cage fighting gang members all day. Not much of a choice, is it? It's kind of like you had a scorpion and cobra, and someone was like, "Which do you want to hold?" And then they go, "Oh, he chose to hold a scorpion." Well, he's dying now, but earlier, she was his choice. These are nonviolent inmates getting paid nothing wages, $1 an hour, $2 an hour. And by the way, when you're in jail, you do have to buy things, toothbrushes and things like that, clothing, and just to make phone calls to your family is often outrageously expensive in prison. Where do they get that money if you show up broke and poor? Well, you do it by working. Massive corporations use this slave labor, which is allowable under our Constitution. About 3,800 inmates, both women and men, fight fires in California, making up about 13% of California's firefighting force. The fire program saves taxpayers $124 million per year, according to the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Okay, by exploiting these poor, desperate people, we can save a few tax. All right, let's do that. What's that average out to? 12 cents a piece? per taxpayer, and then they're often not even trained that well. The training they receive, which often lasts as little as 3 weeks, is significantly less than the 3-year apprenticeship that full-time civilian firefighters get. 3 years compared to 3 weeks. One inmate said, "The pay is ridiculous. There are some days when we are worn down to the core, and this isn't that different from slave conditions." And it's not just fires, of course. According to the Prison Policy Initiative, the average pay for a prison worker is 93 cents an hour. California had a years-long litigation over reducing the population of prisons deemed unconstitutionally overcrowded by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2010. One of the reasons the state gave in court for not paroling more inmates in California was because it would be bad for the economy. You know who else argued that? Plantation owners. Not only is it clear that these inmates are being exploited for their situation, but on top of that, we keep them in jail so that we can exploit them. Corporate Democrat du jour Kamala Harris was the state attorney general at the time that was argued in court. Of course, when it was revealed to the public, she said she was shocked that her office had ever argued such a thing. Look, this is how late-stage capitalism works. People are desperate, and their desperation is exploited. They're willing to put their lives on the line for pennies. And yet NBC News will report on this like it's a feel-good story. It's the power of women. Yes, these are strong women, but that doesn't make this good. That doesn't make this happy. That just makes this an example of desperation. All it really shows is what people will do when they have a police state gun to their head and an economic gun to their head. What choice do these people really have? Now let's get to climate change. And believe it or not, yes, this is still a censored side of the story. The clearest way in which global warming increases wildfire risk, one supported by a growing body of peer-reviewed literature, is higher temperature. Warmer air draws moisture from the plants, trees, soil, increasing what's known as fuel aridity. This provides the dry fuel and conditions that feed wildfires. Other climatic factors are also contribute, including decreased rainfall and reduced or earlier melting mountain snowpack. Basically, what that quote said is, it's hotter and things catch on fire. They said it different. They put in science words. California had a 5-year drought before these fires. Then there was some rainfall, which they thought was going to ease up the wildfire season this year. However, the rainfall was then followed by record-breaking temperatures that basically took away the result of the rainfall. Here's another quote. Indeed, anthropogenic climate change, which means man-made, has doubled the area scorched by forest fires during the last 3 decades across the American West, burning an additional 16,000 square miles, according to a study last year in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Remember, science, it's a thing most of our politicians want to do away with, but it's still around. You can find it in some circles if you go to like a Comic-Con or something. Park Williams, a bioclimatologist at Columbia University, said in a statement, "We should be getting ready for bigger fire years than those familiar to previous generations. It's going to get worse. Our country is going to burn. More than 24 named fires currently burn across Washington and Oregon. More than 1 million acres have burned in Montana. An area larger than Rhode Island has burned in Montana. It's been Montana's third worst fire season on record, and the largest brush fire in the history of Los Angeles happened a few weeks ago. According to climate models, by the end of this century, the western United States is still projected to warm by about another 3.5 degrees Celsius." And when we remember that.
Now, here is what I take away from this. Yes, the environment is getting hotter. We now have millions of sea creatures dying. They're starving to death because the ecological imbalance has been created by the acidification of the water, the loss of coral reef, and many of the species dying off. For the larger sea mammals like sea lions and walruses, and they're no longer available, and whales are even dying. So they have to go to different locations, and sometimes locations that do not have enough food for them. No one seems to be paying attention to this. I mean, no one, meaning the average person, seems to be indifferent to this. They still continue to consume meat products, fish products, and by the way, 80% of all the fish products actually go not to humans, but to cattle. So when you continue to eat cattle, hamburgers or steaks, you're also eating fish that were fed to the cattle. Neither is a good source of protein because it's excessive and harms the liver and kidneys. And it creates havoc with the environment because of the methane and then the depopulation of the fish in the ocean. And so other larger fish are dying. Plus the commercial farming, the monocrops, are mainly genetically engineered soybeans and corn to feed cattle or chickens or pigs. And that creates a destruction of the land. And then rain comes in the spring when the thawing of the ground and washes good quality topsoil into estuaries and rivers and streams and ultimately into the ocean. Now we have the largest dead zone in American history at the Gulf of the Mississippi, right outside of New Orleans. So everything is interconnected. Keep pulling back far enough and you'll see the interconnectivity of all things. So imagine how positive it is when you as an individual or you and your family decide to go meatless one day a week. And then after a month, go meatless 2 days a week. And do it as you can. If you can go all at once, great. But let's just be realistic. Most people cannot make or will not make radical changes in their lifestyle, especially their diet, because you have culture, you have religion, you have conditioning, familial conditioning, you have social conditioning, you have availability, you have knowledge. If you don't know what to do with an eggplant, you're not going to buy an eggplant. If you've never seen celery, you're not going to do anything with it. But once you become educated, then you start to make that change, and then those are good changes. The likelihood is you're going to continue to make those changes. Visit your farmer's market. Visit your food co-op. We have some great food co-ops around the United States and great farmer's markets around the United States, and support them. And more younger people are supporting them, especially the millennials who are highly educated, have information access, and are knowing, why didn't I learn this growing up, the right way to eat? And now they're making that change for themselves and for their family. So I see the next major movement in the United States being a movement towards veganism. I believe that this will start this year and just go on and continue to increase. At the same time, now if you have all those fires in California, don't forget the San Joaquin Valley is in California. In fact, when you go from Los Angeles up to Fresno, you'll fly over it, you can see it. And when that's not going to be as susceptible to fires because they've already cleared out the brush, the underbrush, and many of the trees that otherwise would contribute to it. But it heats up the land. And now we have land so hot that seeds are not germinating and sustaining their growth. They're stunted or they die. Or the other side of that is you get so much rain when it comes down that it over-soaks and destroys, rots out the plant itself or the seed. So we're going to start seeing enormous shift. Last week, we had the first report that 75% of our insect population is gone. What does that mean then for the birds that are major pollinators and the bees and bees don't eat insects, but that means you're going to have a reduction in pollination. 50% of all the bees are gone. So they are responsible for one out of every three things we eat. 30% of our food comes from pollination, including apples and almonds and so many other fruits and vegetables. So between an overheating of the soil, insects dying in such a large number, it's the greatest extinction in the history of insects, and bees decimated by 50%, mainly from neonicotinoids, pesticides. What that means is we are really in trouble when it comes to our future food supply, future meaning now and forward. Not in the future, not 100 years now. I'm talking about now. And in other parts of the world, it's already happening. Major droughts, major food refugees, people just barely subsisting we're starving. So keep that in mind, that we have a lot of problems when it comes to the environment, and staying unaware of the environment and how intimate is that relationship between our own future and health and the environment's future and health. Your developers don't care. Your politicians, most of them, don't care. Your news media are indifferent. As long as you're living in a cloistered environment where you're not seeing the real world, you can be indifferent. Well, I'm not, dying of thirst. I'm not starving to death. And it's not important to me today. That's the wrong attitude. We live in an interconnected world. We should care about everything and everyone. Now, we're going to finish our program today by listening to a part of a conversation, enough to get the message that much of the liberal community today has been compromised, especially the corporate Democrat liberals, the Clinton liberals, the Debbie Wasserman Schultz liberals, the many of the major front groups, the Soros groups. That liberal community is so compromised, so corrupt, so far away from protecting the poor, the inner city, the unions, our jobs, our environment. They've done everything they could to profit and protect themselves, but not the people that historically they had made a measure to help. Let's hear Chris Hedges talk about censorship, the new McCarthyism, with the publisher of Truthdig.
Welcome to On Contact. Today we discuss the silencing of the left with Truthdig editor-in-chief Bob Scheer.
They have created an atmosphere of hysteria that if anyone questions military spending, aggressiveness, anything else, they're going to be thought to be agents of a foreign power. Come on.
On Contact with Chris Hedges. There is strong evidence that Google is suppressing public access to socialist and left-wing websites by using algorithms that divert users away from these sites when they type in certain keywords, such as U.S. military, inequality, socialism, and even figures such as Julian Assange. This censorship is being carried out as part of what Google, along with Facebook, Twitter, The New York Times, Washington Post, BuzzFeed News, Agence France-Presse, and CNN say is a campaign to marginalize fake news. Most of these organizations have strong links to the Democratic Party. RT correspondent Anya Parampel looks at the new McCarthyism that is underway to silence the left-wing press.
Alternative media is under attack like never before, particularly left-wing and anti-war outlets. Since the election of Trump, the establishment has been falling all over itself to stop the spread of what it calls fake news. There's just one problem. While the concept isn't really anything new, remember Saddam's weapons of mass destruction? Some forces have emerged to declare themselves the arbiters of fake news. Specifically, an organization calling itself Prop or Propaganda or Not came forward with a list of Russian influence operations it considers to be fake news. And while it did list RT and Sputnik, organizations which don't hide their connection with the Russian government and operate like any other state media, it also included sites like antiwar.com, Alternet, the Ron Paul Institute, Truthout, and Truthdig, all with zero evidence of the site's relationship with Russia or an influencing operation. They even included Press TV, Iran's state media channel. But this wasn't just a harmless list. Months later, Google announced it was changing its algorithm to filter out fake news. And many sites similar to the ones on that list or on that list have experienced a decline in traffic. Since Google has announced the changes, Alternet says it's experienced a 40% decline in traffic. In September, the World Socialist website reported a 75% drop in traffic since the changes took place. The attack on alternative sites led Julianne Tvetin, a reporter for In These Times, to coin the term the Russia fearmongering industrial complex, saying the campaign is successfully marginalizing the left. RT reached out to Google and asked who exactly they consulted when designing their new algorithm and why left-wing and anti-war sites are being disproportionately affected. And they told us, quote, "Providing users with authoritative and useful information for their search query is our top priority. Because of this, we are constantly improving our algorithms to provide this type of content at scale across the wide range of topics people search for on Google. When we change our algorithms, it does mean some sites may lose visibility. Most importantly, we have never re-ranked search results to manipulate political sentiment."
Thank you, Anya. My guest today is Bob Scheer. He is the editor-in-chief of Truthdig, which has seen its traffic plunge by nearly 20% since the Google algorithms were put in place. I publish a column every Monday on the site. Scheer was formerly a reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times and the editor of Ramparts magazine. He is a professor at the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at the University of Southern California and the author of 13 books, including his latest, They Know Everything About You, How Data Collecting Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy. So, Bob, let's talk about what we're seeing, what you have called repeatedly the new McCarthyism, only this time it's not coming from the rabid right wing, the Joe McCarthy's and of the Republican Party, but from the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I consider this one of the most frightening moments, and I've been around a long time, by the way. I spent 29 years at the Los Angeles Times, legacy media, as a reporter and columnist and so forth. And I want to make one thing clear. Fake news has always been a problem. Okay, fake news comes from governments all over the world, particularly when it deals with national security. I was sitting there at
the CIA has made
I was sitting there at the Los Angeles Times 20 years after the Gulf had sunk in, which was this supposed attack, the second one on by North Vietnamese PT boats on a destroyer and aircraft carrier of the U.S., you know, these huge ships, and it never happened.
Well, just like the attack on the Maine in the harbor of Havana,
right.
Never happened.
Okay,
right.
But a lot of people knew it, including the president and Secretary of Defense, Lyndon Johnson, Ron Mayer, and what came out 20 years after the fact when the key documents were finally declassified, and I wrote about it for the Los Angeles. They knew before they talked to the nation, the president and secretary of defense, that there was no evidence of an attack. They were warned by Captain Herrick. I interviewed him. The guy was on the destroyer saying, we recommend holding off. There is no evidence, you know. Admiral Stockdale, who was the longest held prisoner of war, was up there in a plane. He couldn't talk about it because he was then captured and being one of the pilots sent over. And he ended up writing a book. He said, I was awakened, go bomb North Vietnam. I said, what for? They said, because we were attacked. He said, there was no attack. I was flying above. So that's like the invasion of Iraq. We're talking really
right.
Major fake news. This is not some yo-yos, you know, somewhere in Russia or Ukraine or somebody, you know, doing stuff. And by the way, that kind of stuff is done by every government now in the world. That's what my book was about. As Eric Schultz pointed out, it's you can take third-rate stuff off the shelf and be a two-bit dictator somewhere, and you can get massive amounts of information, disrupt communication. This is what happened.
But the fact is that the charges that fake news somehow elected Trump, I mean, this is... it is true that every government does it, but they've not offered any evidence.
Okay, let me address this. This is the most shameful moment for the Democratic Party establishment in, I think, maybe in my lifetime. Because at least in the old McCarthy, this is the new McCarthy period, and the old McCarthy period, okay, it was coming from the right, and the warmongers,
right.
You know, and they were attacking Democrats in the State Department, you know, for selling out or being subversive. Also, that red baiting campaign was based on reds. There were red revolutionaries,
right, right.
And they did have a program of, you know, revolution and so forth. The red baiting now is not directed at the last significant Communist Party. You know, I wouldn't mention North Korea. I don't think was ever really a Communist Party, but China.
Yeah.
Okay, and they've turned out to be the most splendid capitalists in the world. Splendid, at least, in being able to make a lot of money and make products that people want. And Russia is run by people who I consider to be quite conservative. You know, I wrote the introductory preface to Oliver Stone, the transcript of Oliver Stone's interview with Putin, and Putin is very clear that he thinks communism is a failed ideology. It was always a pipe dream. He thinks Gorbachev was naive to think he could save it. And he believes in this kind of variation of crony capitalism. I mean, he's unabashed in his support of what I, as a progressive, don't like. I, I still have an idea we can have some social democratic society that is fair and just. So the irony in this red baiting is that it's fundamentally illogical. You know, Putin's Russia does not have a grand design to spread an ideology around the world. What it is it's old-fashioned nationalism. You could trace it back to the czars, if you like. You know, they were abused. I was in Russia covering it for the Los Angeles Times when Gorbachev was doing perestroika and glasnost and so forth. It was a feeding frenzy for American experts, NGOs, agents, blah, 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 all over the place. Yeltsin was their guy.
Well, the CIA okay. put millions.
Yeah, Yeltsin was their guy against Gorbachev, really. And Putin came out of the St. Petersburg crowd, the Sobchak and so forth. He was brought into the Yeltsin government. And then Yeltsin, in desperation, turned to Putin because he was the only guy that wasn't a drunk and out for himself and was competent. And he said, look, I got to resign, but you got to take over. And then Yeltsin wins the election the next year against the Communist Party candidate. So the red baiting is against a guy who was an anti-communist. And they bring up, oh, you know, it's KGB. Well, how many CIA people, you know, have we had in government? You know, what
well,
does that
mean?
Well,
we had one as President Bush.
Yeah, the first President Bush.
But let's talk about what is it that the Democratic Party, first of all, let's talk about what they're doing in terms of the red baiting, and then tell me why they're doing it.
There are two forces operating here, and it's so disreputable because it's basically at the heart of it petty, yet its destructiveness is enormous. One is you have legend media, as it's called, the New York Times, Washington Post, particularly the Washington Post, you know, and others, whose business model is destroyed. So the Washington Post gets saved by Jeff Bezos, who buys it as his personal property. Meanwhile, his company, Amazon, is building the cloud for the intelligence agency, CIA. So you have the old military-industrial complex. And the Washington Post has been leading this attack, and the Russians are everywhere. Meanwhile, they're building the cloud for the CIA and the NSA and everything. And their guy, Bezos, owns the Washington Post. He's the publisher, so much for independent legend newspaper. But also the New York Times have been just beating the drum on this, you know, with no evidence that they've been able to come up
well,
with.
Well, so is CNN. So is MSNBC.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the publications that I really respect or have respected through my life. I mean, I like Dean Baquet, who's the editor of the New York Times. I think he's a solid fellow. I like Marty Baron, who's the editor. I mean, I've worked with these people. They were both
right.
at the LA Times
right.
When I was there. And I think it's really an embarrassment. I say shame.
So what's their goal? What are they doing?
They're doing it because their business model is broken and this internet, this crazy, wild world. Yes. And the internet is the best and the worst of everything. That's what I find it exciting. I edit Truth Dig, and we can...
So we're at the end of our program. Let me just... You can finish watching this. I've posted their interview. Tomorrow, Chris Hedges live on this program, and we'll go further into it. But it shows you that by having Google and Facebook begin to censor all of the progressive and truly liberal publications, humanistic publications, and sites, then you won't get any traffic to those. In effect, you're going to cause it to wither and die on the vine. And some of these sites are down 50-60%. And that's the left doing that, right? And not the right. We have enough problems from the right, but who expected that the people in the Trojan horse would be the so-called, we're your companions, we care about you, you're poor, you're people of color. You know, put us in office. We'll see that we do the right by you. Absolutely pathological liars. They've done just the opposite. And by the way, my second point on the fires is that they're exploiting prison labor. Now, here's the bad part. When you get out of prison, having served all year on prison fire detail, you cannot apply to become a firefighter in California. Talk about rank hypocrisy. There's so much hypocrisy in California to begin with that this is just the toxic cherry on the top of it. You're willing to let someone die, put them in harm's way, give them improper training, pay them $1 an hour, and that is under extremely dangerous conditions, and yet you won't let them go out to become a firefighter after they get out of prison? Well, shame on you. But then again, I cannot say enough. Shame on people running California from the governor on because they don't understand shame. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.